Erev Tov, everyone. Welcome to Torah 1.0 here at SPL. We are in what is known as Parashat Emor. Emor is the 31st division of the Torah. Emor is coming from the Hebrew verb amar, which means to say or to speak. And a little bit later, we're going to talk about kind of what type of speech is amar or emor. In Hebrew, there are two distinct ways that the text can say God spoke to Moses. Amar is one of those. But what type of speech is it when contrasted with other ways that Hashem speaks to Moses? Emor covers Leviticus chapter 21 through chapter 24. This is the portion of the Torah that, in addition to having more instructions for the priests, so for the last several portions, they've been in many ways a mini instruction manual for the priests, but we can also see the relevance of that for us when we take seriously the idea not only that the Torah has for us, but also what Simon Peter says when we are all to be considered priests in the kingdom of God. And therefore, in many ways, these instructions do apply to us. And so we've been trying to unpack different ways that that is the case. But even more to the point, beyond more rules and aspects for the priesthood, this portion, by its very title, Emor, has to do with speech, things we should and shouldn't say. So again, imagine that you open up your scriptures. And when you do, you know, the pages glow and you can see the divine energy coming off of the page. What really is coming off the page in Leviticus 21 through 24? And it has to do with speech. And even more specifically, the portion teaches that how we perform an action is often more important than the action itself. All right. So how we do something is very often more important than the very thing we are doing. What's our motivation behind it? What's our reason behind it? What's our kavana? What's our intention behind it? Those matter more. Those things have more weight. And in many of those cases, our mouth is usually involved in the process. So we can connect to this reading, and when we do, we can use the power of Emor to help us speak the truth and have the right intention behind our actions. So that's what we're going to try to connect to this week in Leviticus 21 through 24. So let's look at our Hebrew lesson in those opening words from the portion. And again, I have to say, I'm just digging this new Shoftim font here, this nice Torah script. Outside of the vowel pointing, that is the way the Torah looks in an actual Torah scroll. That's why I really like that font. There's something special about the crowns and so forth that are given there. But the portion opens by saying, Emor el ha-kohanim. Now, we've already kind of talked about emor. It means to speak, to say. All right? This is coming from kind of the second person. You might even think imperative. You say. All right? It's speaking to someone that they would do something. So, say. El is the Hebrew preposition to, T-O. So, say to. Ha kohanim. Whenever you see a noun ending in im, I-N, which is these two letters here, lets you know that it's plural. Alright? So this is the plural of kohen. Some of you probably know what kohen is. What is a kohen? Think of people you know with last names. Cohen. Alright? That's coming from this. It means a priest. So Kohanim is the plural, priests. So say to the priests is what this Hebrew lesson here is saying. Emor el ha-Kohanim. So let's say that together. Ready? Emor el ha-Kohanim. All right. So this portion of Emor includes precepts that pertain to the Kohen Hagadol, the priest, the great one, right, the high priest. We may find ourselves asking, why is it important to know about priestly duties in the time of Moses? When we ask that question, the first response we should have to ourselves or to whoever may ask that of us is that everything in the Bible gives us some knowledge and understanding that we can use in our daily lives. Everything. Everything in the Bible is legitimate, genuine, spiritual technology that we can use in our daily lives, including the duties of the priests in the time of Moses. There's not one superfluous word or letter in the entire Bible, including even the way that has the decorations on top of the letters. None of that is inconsequential. Reading about the priest teaches us, among many things, I think this very important lesson, that the spiritual work of one person is not the same as the spiritual work of another person. That is, the spiritual work of one person is not identical to that of another. The reason why my soul was put into my body, into this earth, in this time and place, is not the same reason God put your soul into your body in this time and place. In many ways, while we may function as one and as a unity, our individual work is not identical. The priests were doing work on behalf of the entire nation of Israel, but theirs was not the work that everyone was expected to undertake. Each one of us has our own level of spiritual work, and the nature of this work is also constantly changing. So when we mature spiritually, or when we elevate to a higher level, what was good enough for us today may not be good enough for us tomorrow. In fact, the things that I believe, that I hold dear, the things that I cherish now, many of them, one, I either didn't even know about 10 years ago, or even if I knew about them 10 years ago, they didn't matter a whole lot to me 10 years ago. But now, they mean everything to me. And things that got me through 10 years ago, while still I would uphold their truth value and their importance and their relevance, they are not the things that are getting me through now. Things change in our spiritual work. It's a dynamic. And I hope that's the case for the rest of my life. I hope in 10 years when I'm teaching here that I'm teaching with you, or I'm sharing with you. Again, I don't teach, I share. I'm sharing with you things that I don't even know right now. And things that have made a difference in my life that I have yet to experience. One of the saddest things I often and unfortunately see quite a bit within the church is an individual in their 60s or 70s who's been in church literally their whole life, since they were a baby on mom and dad's knee in the pew. And their faith in their 60s and 70s really isn't much different than it was when they were 10 or 15 or 25. That their level of understanding of the text is the same. Their understanding of the biblical characters is the same. I find that sad. And that's often why people get frustrated in the church, is because it's not maturing you. It's not moving you along. It's not challenging you and helping you understand why are you here in this world. It just continues to spoon feed us the same milk week after week, year after year, when there's a whole lot of meat that could be offered. And that's one of the things we see as we go through the way all of the different priests and the different where they function and how they function is spiritual work is different at different times for different people, and that's always changing. Most of our spiritual work, in fact, will consist of mainly finding out what our spiritual work truly is. And once we probably figure that out, it's time to be working on something else. But if we don't know where we're supposed to go, you certainly will never get there. In this sense, I think life is like an escalator. If we're constantly trying to go up the down escalator, we will not end up where we intended. In his great work entitled in Hebrew, Mesilat Yesharim, usually translated as The Path of the Just, written by the Ramchal, he sums it up when he says, every person should know what they're supposed to do in this world. Every person should know what they're supposed to do in this world. And so when we look at these commandments and these outlines for the priest and the high priest, it's informing them what their spiritual work is. What are they supposed to do? Where are they fitting in bringing light and redemption and atonement? Where do they fit in this process? Even Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai learned this lesson. This is one of my favorite tales. And when I go to Israel, I love to go and spend my time in the Galilee, because that's where my master Yeshua lived and did most of his ministry. But also in the northern part of the Galilee is a little town called Maron. It's kind of a twin city to what's known as Sfat or Sfed. And in Maron is the resting place of an individual named Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai. Now, when I tell you what his name means, I think you'll begin to understand who this individual actually is. Shimon Bar Yochai means Simon, the son of the living God. Can you make a connection there? Oh, and by the way, he had 11 close friends. This is all part of the tradition. In fact, when you go there, you see the seats for his 11 friends. So you have a Simon, son of the living God, as his nickname, who lived in the Galilee in the first century and had 11 friends who studied Torah with him. One of those students was named Yochanan ben Zakkai, John, the son of Zechariah. And I could give you the names of the other ones, but I think you get where they would also be sounding like. All right, so this is one of the ways that even Orthodox Judaism has embedded within itself some of our great teachers, including Simon Peter. And so I like to go there, and I like to kind of absorb the culture there. It's a very unique place. But one of the things about Shimon Bar Yochai is that he apparently spent 12 years in a cave. And this is what the story says. When he emerged after 12 years in the cave, where he had taken refuge from the Romans, he saw people working in the fields, and he said to himself, how can these people leave the tree of life? How can these people forsake the study of Torah to do farm work? And then it says, wherever he looked, the field would burst into flames. Right? And again, it's not literal. That means judgment. He was judging them harshly. And then a voice from the sky said, Rab Shimon, did you come out to destroy the world? You go back into your cave. So Rabbi Shimon went back into his cave, which, by the way, if you know where it's at, you can go to this cave. Rab Shimon comes out in the 13th year, at which time his response to the work going on in the world was very different. Previously, he had seen everyone according to his perspective of the truth, which held that intense Bible study and only intense Bible study was the true meaning of life. To immerse yourself into Bible study nonstop, day and night, don't have a job, don't do anything else but study the Torah 24/7, all the time. That was the only true meaning of life. But now he saw that this was not the same work for everyone else. Not everyone else was on that level. Not everyone else was capable of doing that. And if everyone did that, then other things that needed to be done, including for the kingdom, wouldn't be getting done. And so what Shimon learned in that 13th year in the cave, which is significant with the number 13, is that everyone is on a different level, and everyone has a different work. Everyone has, if you look in your Hebraic toolbox, everyone has a different tikkun in this world. Everyone is put into this world to accomplish something differently for God's sake. And so that is part of what's packed into reading these instructions regarding the priest and the high priest. It's trying to teach us that even within the priests, different priests did different things and had different responsibilities. And those would even change over time or as circumstances changed. And the same is true in our own life. So now I want to talk about soft speech and hard speech. Since the name of this week's portion is Emor, meaning to say or to speak. Well, the Torah mainly uses two words for speaking. And those two words are the Hebrew davar and the Hebrew amar. And I have them listed up there on the screen for you. The first word for speech, davar, is reserved for what is called hard speech. And many times in the Torah, it might say something like, "And the Lord said to Moses, say unto the people." It might be, "And the Lord davarred to Moses and said, amar to the people." Or it might say, "And the Lord amarred to Moses and said, davar to the people." Right? So even if your English is using say and speak, it could have two different words behind it. And those words matter. Hard speech, what I mean by that, is straightforward, accurate delivery of the message. Amar, soft speech, is tailoring the message to its intended recipient in order to ensure that the message is indeed received correctly and understood clearly. Davar doesn't really worry about that aspect. It just gives you the information. It just proclaims and confronts. That's Davar. It just proclaims the truth. It confronts you with the truth. And that's it. Davar. Amar is more concerned about, did you really hear what I said? Did you truly understand what I said the way I meant for you to understand it? Not just did you get the facts, but did you receive it in the spirit that I meant it in? Did you receive it in the tone that I meant it in? Did you understand it in the context that I meant it in? Like it really wants to make sure the recipient has understood it. So Amar seeks to understand, and it seeks to be understood. It seeks to understand, it seeks to be understood. The first part of this section of the Torah in Amor, which contains the laws regarding the priest's duty to educate their children, and one of the responsibilities of the priesthood, is couched exclusively in this soft speech of Amar. It is only when God returns to other laws concerning the priests that he once again uses the hard speech of Davar. So what does this teach us in that in one particular section of the Torah, God exclusively uses this soft speech, this speech that seeks to understand and to be understood, especially as it's in the section relating to educating children. It teaches us that we must educate primarily with soft speech, that if we truly want important information to be conveyed to someone, that we don't do it by presenting and confronting. That's not the way you're going to get into someone's heart, and that's just the way you're going to potentially give them some head knowledge, but it certainly isn't going to penetrate their heart. In order to be effective and reach the heart and understand and be understood, Educators must relate fully to their students and tailor their style of delivery accordingly. They have to make sure that what they're saying is being actually heard. And if it's not, then it's their job as part of soft speech to find out what the barrier is. And so, again, Hebrew has these two different words for speak, and sometimes it's very helpful when you're reading through the Bible and you see these passages where it'll say, and the Lord said to Moses, say to the children of Israel, or Moses said to Aaron. It's really helpful if you can know which one of these two are being used, because devar means it's being confrontational. It's just being straightforward. It's aggressive. Where amar is being more invitational. It's seeking to understand and be understood. God's imperative regarding how priests should educate their youth really applies to all of us. Whenever we see in someone's behavior or attitude that they are in need of either inspiration or even a correction in their life or lifestyle, we are immediately cast by divine providence into the role of educator, which means we are cast into the role of speaking with amar, not devar. And so we must remember God's example in those situations when we are seeking to inspire someone, when we are seeking to help someone make a correction in their life. The impulse to help someone make a correction in their life is to confront them, devar. But the Torah says that isn't going to work. The way to do it is amar, to make use of soft speech. Now, I want to look at this next verse, and when I put it up, it's going to be my translation. It's going to be the FIV, the Foster International Version. And for those who were here this past weekend, we had a good time in Micah with the FIV, didn't we, right? So the FIV, but I want you to know how it's nuanced is that it's quite literal. It's quite literal. Okay? So let's look at Leviticus 21, verse 1. God told Moses, speak to the Kohanim, speak to the priests, the descendants of Aaron. We could talk about that because by nature, the Kohanim are descendants of Aaron. So why the redundancy? Redundancy doesn't exist in the Torah. So there is something being told to us. Torah 2.0. Speak to the Kohanim, the descendants of Aaron. Let no Kohen, let no priest defile himself by contact with a dead soul. I don't know of any English translation that says dead soul. But that is literally what the Hebrew says. Doesn't say dead body. Says dead soul among his people. So why are Kohanim, why are the priests not allowed to come into contact with the dead? But, you know, it's not really even saying that, because it's saying that are not to come into contact with a dead soul. Why does the Torah say that? After all, is it not the body that dies and not the soul? Is not the soul immortal? So what's going on here? I mean, this is some good stuff here. And it's unfortunate that our translators decide to clean stuff up for us, right? Because then we never get to wrestle with these good things. It's all dealing with the illusion of death. Death, from a Torah perspective, is an illusion. It is an illusion. And to help kind of understand this passage and in its greater context of Torah theology, I want to use a parable that Rabbi Tukhachinsky wrote in his book Gesher HaChaim, which deals with mourning rituals. But he tells this parable to explain not only this verse, but kind of the real view of death. Now, it's a parable, so really pay attention, because this is a brilliant, brilliant parable. It's got so many layers to this onion. Like, some of it's going to be obvious, but I'm telling you, if you really listen to it, it's just a gold mine. It's just layer after layer after layer. So here is the parable from Rabbi Tuchinsky. Twin brothers, fetuses in their mother's womb, were enjoying a carefree life. Their world was dark, warm, and protected. These twins were all alike in all aspects but one. One brother was a believer, which meant that this brother actually believed in an afterlife. He believed that there was a future reality that was much different from their current miniature universe. That though it was good, something better and completely different awaited them. The second brother, however, was a skeptic. All he knew was what he knew, and he refused to know any more. All he knew was the familiar world that was the womb. Anything besides what he could feel and sense was of no use to him. It was but an illusion. The skeptic, of course, tried to talk some sense into his brother. He warned him to be realistic, but to no avail. His naive brother insisted on believing in an extraordinary world that exists after life in the womb. A world so immense and fantastic that it could transcend their wildest dreams. Months passed, and the fatal moment arrived. Labor began. The fetuses became aware of tremendous contractions and shifting in their little world. The free thinker recognized that this is it. His short but pleasant life was now about to end and be completely over. He felt the forces pressuring him to go down, but he fought against it with every fiber of his being. He knew that outside that womb was nothing but a cruel death, no protective sac, no umbilical cord. But suddenly he realized that his naive brother was giving in to the forces around them. His brother was willingly sinking lower. "Don't give up," he cried. But the twin took no heed. "Where are you, my dear brother?" He shuddered as his brother disappeared and he heard the screams from outside the womb. His poor brother had met a cruel fate. How naive that believer had been with his foolish belief in this bigger, better world. And then the skeptic felt the uterine muscles pushing him out against his will into the abyss. And then he heard a scream, "Mazel tov," said the doctor. "Two healthy baby boys." In other words, we all going to end up in the same place, but the journey can be quite different. Rav Kook wrote this: "Death is a false illusion. Its defilement is due to its deceptive nature." This is, by the way, why the priests couldn't get near death. "What people call death is, in fact, the intensification of life. Because man wallows in pettiness, he pictures this increase of life in a pained black fashion, which he calls death." And think about how much we fight death tooth and nail. How much we fight to stay in the womb. When in reality, something greater exists beyond the womb. Death is the illusion. The Kohanim in their holiness, the priests in their holiness, were able to rise above this falsehood. But the falsehood and deception rule over this world. We live in a culture of death. We live in a culture dominated by death. In order to overcome this illusion of death, the priests therefore had to limit their exposure to it. They needed to protect themselves from the images that would impress the soul with deceiving messages. It's the great lie we've all bought into, that death is not a beginning, but death is an end. When in reality, the truth is, death, physical death, is the beginning, not the end. It is the beginning of a reality that we can't even fathom or imagine. But it is definitely not the end. But yet, almost every message we receive from every perspective tells us how negative death is. Death isn't the enemy. The illusion of death is the enemy. And so to be free of that, the priest avoided contact with it so that it would not change their perspective, so that they would understand what reality is, true reality. Rav Berg once commented, he said, you know, when we go to a funeral and you look around, people are sighing and gasping and there's heartbreak as if we're saying goodbye. But what's the perspective of the one who's gone on? They're looking back and saying, you guys have got it wrong. You guys have got it wrong. Who has the right view of reality? The illusion of death, our fear of death, our captivity to death, our avoidance of death, that is the great enemy, and that is the sting that death has. But the Torah says, as real as that is on one hand, it's also an illusion on the other. I'd encourage you to listen again to that parable. It's got some real good meat in its layers. Moses and the blasphemer. Leviticus 24:10. The son of the Israelite woman whose father was an Egyptian went out among the children of Israel. I think you're really going to enjoy this little section, because it ties together a lot of things going on in the Torah, and it makes use of some of your Hebraic toolbox, some of which I will highlight, some of which I will tell you where to go to see the rest of it in action. But we will find out just through this verse who was the man Moses killed. Why did Moses kill him? And how their lives continually intersect. And even as we continue in the Torah, Moses and this incident and the individuals involved are forever tied for the rest of his earthly life. In fact, later we get names, but we'll have to wait till we get there. But I think you're really going to enjoy here kind of what's going on in the text. So this is kind of the last portion in Parashat Emor, chapter 24. It's the concluding section. And it recounts the story of a man who curses God. The Torah is very quick to note, as 24 verse 10 states, that this man was the son of an Israelite woman, a Hebrew woman. He's a Jewish mama, but he has an Egyptian daddy. Because his mother was from the tribe of Dan, here in Leviticus 24, it says that, what I think is quite logical, this gentleman tries to set up his tent, his home, within the area allotted to the tribe of Dan. Makes sense, doesn't it? His mom is a Danite. So why would he not set up camp with the other people of Dan? After all, your Jewishness, if you will, from halacha, is if mommy's Jewish, you're Jewish. Mommy's Jewish. He should be setting up in Dan, right? However, the Torah story, as it goes, he's told the right to camp with a particular tribe is a matter of the lineage of the father, not the mother. So while your Hebrewness, your Israeliteness, your Jewishness may come through mama, your tribal link and identity comes through your father. Since he had an Egyptian father, he could not camp with the tribe of Dan. So he decides to take the case to court, to the Beit Din, and there the judges ruled against him. At this point, he then curses God, which is an extremely serious infraction. Now, tellingly, this is kind of a bookend. A lot of things in the Torah and in the Gospels, for that matter, happen as bookends. You have something introduced, or I call it the sandwich model. You have something introduced, you've got some filler and some meat and some peanut butter and jelly in the middle that really doesn't connect to the meat, or the first piece of bread, or the first bookend. And then you have, all of a sudden, the other bookend, the other piece of bread that links the beginning and the end with some stuff in the middle. It's very classic Hebraic style, and that's what you have going on in Amor. And so this ending section is actually linked to the beginning part of Amor, where physical blemishes that disqualify priests from performing certain temple services are discussed. Although the blasphemer's blemish was not a physical one, within the context of camp life, he could never forget the emotional badge of shame that he had to wear. While his ultimate outburst was indeed entirely unacceptable, the pain he experienced every day was quite real and understandably hard to bear. Nevertheless, like all souls that enter into this world, the blasphemer had a choice on how he could deal with his lot in life. The classic, you can get bitter or you can get better. Classic dichotomy that presents itself to us time and time again in life. When life happens to us, we can get bitter or we can get better. In general, we can adopt one of two attitudes when life just happens. Such as, you have no control who your father is. He has no control that his father was Egyptian. That's just life that happened to him. But he can choose, or he could have chosen, how to respond to his father being an Egyptian. On one hand, we can believe that everything that happens has a real reason and purpose, that ultimately all is for the best, and that in the end, however long it takes for the end to come, justice will prevail, even if at the present time that seems not only far from likely, but absolutely and fundamentally impossible. This is what's known as emunah, true faith. Or we can believe that life has no intrinsic rhyme or reason, that everything happens as a result of either blind luck, fate, or how hard or how little we work, and that we have no real reason to expect that all really will turn out for the best and that justice will prevail. Obviously, depending on how we approach life, our experience of life will be significantly different. And so what's going to be happening in the text is the life of Moses and the life of this blasphemer are going to be contrasted. Just like in the Gospels, when you have Simon Peter and the story of Judas kind of running into one another in a narrative where that doesn't flow really well. It's doing the same bookend kind of thing to try to draw you to contrast. Two men did the same thing. Two men did the same thing. But how they chose to deal with what they did made all the difference in the world. Perspective, by and large, is reality. And how we choose to define our perspective on what is happening will affect how we live our life. So the section describing this incident of the blasphemer, it begins with these words in Leviticus 24:10. And the son of the Israelite woman, whose father was an Egyptian, went out among the children of Israel. In the Chumash, Rashi dwells on the phrase went out quite a bit. And he uses that in a Hebraic toolbox way, as a verbal tally, as a gezerah shavah. And he assumes or uses those techniques to imply that the blasphemer was in some sense inside before he went outside. And then Rashi spends a great deal of time of, well, what was he on the inside of? And then what did he go into the outside of? We're not really going to dwell too much on that. I just want to make you aware of that. That Rashi spends a great bit of time on went out and gives a wide range of meanings. From the straightforward pashat of the text, that he went into the court hall and he came out of it, to more on the remez, dorash, and sod level. One reading that Rashi proposes is that this story is connected to, went out of, comes out of, the previous section of the Torah, which describes the weekly ritual of the priest placing 12 loaves of bread on the table in the tabernacle and eventually the temple. When the priest placed the new loaves, they ate the loaves from the preceding week. Rashi reports a tradition from the Midrash that the blasphemer scoffed at this practice because he reasoned how foolish it was for them to eat week-old, stale bread instead of the piping hot, fresh bread from the oven. The anecdote confirms the assumption that the blasphemer had become so bitter with his lot in life that it led him to belittle and find fault with everything around him, particularly aspects of religious law, because remember it was a religious law that said he couldn't camp with Dan. And so Rashi spends some time and he uses verbal tallies and gezerah shavah and some midrash to show that this individual had chose to become bitter in life. Which meant no matter what happened, he chose to see the negative in it. What wasn't good enough about it, what was wrong about it, what was silly about it, what was nonsensical about it, what didn't make sense about it. Nothing was good enough. The other reading, I think, that is of note that Rashi points out is that this incident went out of, the discussion of the blemishes at the beginning of the portion. Structurally, I think that fits a very Hebraic idea, the bookends, the opening and the ending being connected. The blasphemer's psychological blemish, his emotional blemish, was as real as any physical blemish, if not even more so. The Midrash, and here's where I think you'll like this, the Midrash notes that the blasphemer's father was actually the Egyptian Moses killed when he witnessed him beating a Jewish slave. And how that is determined is brilliant, and it's so Hebraic mindset. It's a verbal tally, but it also incorporates some other things from your toolbox. The only two places in your Bible where the phrase Egyptian man occur are Moses killing the Egyptian man, and here. And so from a Hebraic mind, not a Western 21st century Gentile I went to Bible college mind, but from a Hebraic mind, it says if that's the only two places when the Bible clearly talks about Egypt and men a lot, if that's the only two places Egyptian man occurs, those are the same people. And that is, from a Jewish perspective, so logical and so right on. Okay, so that's where the Midrash derives it. That's where Rashi derives it, right? It would be like if you read a book that was 1,000 pages. And only in two places did it say, the crazy guy with red curly hair and blue eyes wearing a clown nose. You would, in the course of reading that book, go, those pretty much got to be the same person. Like, what's the likelihood of that? That's the way Hebraic eyes read this. So, this individual's father is not only an Egyptian that's keeping him kind of out and causing this shame from being able to camp with the people of his mother's people, but Moses is the one that killed his dad. This Egyptian had slipped into the blasphemer's mother's bed, the Midrash says, while her husband was at work one night, and unbeknownst to her, she slept with him. When her husband found out, the Egyptian beat him mercilessly. If you want to know more about that, you can look, if you have a Chumash, Rashi on Exodus chapter 2, verse 11 discusses that. From this unholy union, the blasphemer was born. Again, it's not his fault. Life happens. How do you respond to life? In saving the blasphemer's non-biological father, Moses lost his privileged status as prince of Egypt and had to flee for his life. Thus, the lives of Moses and this blasphemer are profoundly intertwined. And it ain't done yet here. It comes back later in the Torah with some whining and some griping and some people who try to lead a rebellion against Moses. It's the same person. A comparison of how the blasphemer and Moses dealt with the seemingly fickle blows of life, I think, is quite instructive in what the Torah is really getting at for us. The blasphemer was bitter and rebellious, and chose to take a perspective of life that everything is negative, everything is against him, and everything is not what it should be. He felt that he was the victim of cruel fate, and this ultimately led to the outburst in which he cursed God for his plight. Moses could have reacted the same way. One day he is the prince of Egypt. The next day he is a fugitive. Furthermore, it seems as if the person who informed the authorities about Moses' action was in fact the same Jew that Moses saved. The blasphemer's non-biological father was the tattletale. How do we get that from the Torah? The day after Moses killed the Egyptian, when he saw two Hebrews fighting, and he tried to break them up, the Midrash says that one of the men taunted Moses, subtly threatening him to turn him over to the authorities if he didn't mind his own business. This man, according to the Midrash, was the blasphemer's non-biological father, because it actually does some pretty cool things in the text to show that he is the only one who could have known about the murder. Thus, the man Moses had saved, instead of showing Moses gratitude, actually threatened him. And immediately after that confrontation, Moses' murder of the Egyptian became known to Pharaoh, and Moses had to flee. And so Moses lost, from his perspective at that time, everything. He lost absolutely everything. Having lost his privileged status as a prince of Egypt, suffering 40 years of exile as a fugitive shepherd, all for defending a thankless individual who turned him in. Moses would have had many opportunities to bewail his fate. Yet he never loses hope, he never descends into despair, he never curses his people, he never curses the God of Israel. This approach to life may have been one of the reasons God chose him to lead Israel from slavery to freedom. So although we cannot control all that happens to us in our lives, we cannot control who our father is or who our mother is or where we were born or what time we were born or when we were born or how we were born, we can control our reactions and we can control how we define not only what those situations mean for us, but who and what God is in those situations. This is the secret and the power of choice and perception. And remember, perception becomes our reality. This is one of the powers of creation that God gave to us. We will all be tested. We will all have blemishes. This is an existential reality that none of us can avoid. Yet we all have the power to determine how we choose to react to events and to forces beyond our control. That is, we have the power to determine how we actually experience life. Life may happen to us, but we define how we experience it. This understanding of Amor's narrative framework, the theme of physical and psychological blemishes and how we might better deal with them, leads to another insight regarding the structure of this week's portion. Right in the middle of Amor, the Torah repeats the entire holiday cycle, including the Sabbath. Again, the Gospels do this stuff all the time. Amor is a classic case of this Hebraic way of doing it. Oh, let me start telling you about the blemishes of a priest and what excludes a priest, and priests should do this and priests can't do that. Oh, okay. Let me review the seven festivals and tell you all about the Sabbath. Oh, and by the way, there's this guy and he curses God, right? You're just like, at first you're just like, what the heck is going on? Like, this is all over the place. But it's not, right? It's not. Now that we know the bookends, we now know the content of the books. We now know what's in the sandwich. Okay? Why is there a review of the entire holiday, the holy days, including that Sabbath? Why this review provides, on one hand, new and important information? How is it connected to the beginning and the end? In light of the insight we've just discussed, we can see that the Sabbath and the holidays bring a welcome relief from the constant grind of personal, financial, and professional concerns that occupy so much of our time during the year and during the week. The Sabbath is a fundamental way, a fundamental technology to deal with life when it happens. We can become overwhelmed during the week by life and problems. We can be overcome and overwhelmed during a certain cataclysmic kind of year for us. And it can become hard for us to see the forest for the trees. We are so often lost in the maze of the world's blemishes, our blemishes, others' blemishes. The Sabbath and the holidays provide us with the opportunity to step back and see the true context of our lives and to see God for who He truly is. They are our appointments to take a time out from life, to regain our perspective, to define our perspective, and so that we can better deal with life. And so when we ignore the Sabbath, and when we ignore the holidays, and when we ignore the festivals, we are ignoring those opportunities that God has given to us to recharge, to refuel, to refocus, to redefine, to reform, to reboot, so that we can go back at it again. The joy and the spiritual delight of the holy days allows us to see beyond the superficial and remember our true purpose. During these moments of clarity, we are able to free ourselves from the imperfections of the world, and our own blemishes disappear, even if but for the 25 hours of the Sabbath. Only inner peace and acceptance reign. On the Sabbath and the holidays, the soul can truly sense its ultimate wholeness and purity, recognizing that deep within, there is no blemish on our soul, especially when we understand who our Messiah is. And finally, creating angels. Leviticus 21, verse 8 says, "And you made him holy because he sacrifices God's bread." It's my translation. Why does the Bible have to tell us that the Kohen HaGadol, the high priest, was pure when he sacrificed the bread? Wasn't it enough that he was a priest? Why do we need the precise details of what he did in the tabernacle, and later would do in the temple, and what his spiritual condition was when he did it? Here, the Torah is teaching us what most of the time we fail to realize. And that is, we don't always see the effects of our actions. But the high priest did see the effects of his actions whenever he performed the sacrifice. And by virtue of this, he was made holy. Of course, the teaching here does not just apply to the high priests or the priests in Moses' time. I'm going to say something that probably isn't going to sit well, but here we go. Every time we perform a negative action, we create a negative angel. And every time we do a positive action, we create a good angel. This is Torah. Words matter. How was the universe created? With words, right? God spoke. God said. Words are the creative forces of the universe. And if you really think about that, not only from a biblical perspective, you'll realize that's the truth all the way down to you reading a textbook to figure out how to make a chemical equation work. It's the words that teach you how to do these things. Words are elements of creation, including your words. Every time you speak, you are creating. We create whole worlds and we destroy whole worlds just with our mouths. Every time you speak, you are creating an angel. Do I mean a cute little chubby baby with wings flying around? No. Do I mean a celestial being? No. What are angels? They are, at its core, messengers. Every time you speak, you are creating. And we already know this, and we already have sayings that convey this. And you know this from reality. Someone calls you, your dad, your father, even if you're an adult child, your father calls you and says, "I am so disappointed in you." And then talks about how awesome your brother and your sister are, and how you just never lived up to the potential. Did he not create something negative in your life? Did he not just send a very destructive, evil angel that will for a while possess your brain? Or a kid runs off the field after having struck out 3 times. Son, you were awesome. So proud of you. I love you. You know, when I was your age, I was too scared to even play on the team. I can't believe you have the courage to do this. Every time you go up there, I'm just so proud of who you are. You don't think you created a little thing called self-esteem? You don't think you created something positive there? Our task is to be aware of this reality and then to act accordingly, just as the priest did. It is important to always remember that even a small action can have the greatest of consequences. I see it time and time again in counseling as a pastor. So many problems we have as adults are the lies we believed that we were told about ourselves as children. And so many people who are so successful in life and so good at life, if you will, it's very often a consequence of what they believe they were told about themselves. I don't know how the ethical committee, I guess it was before ethics were allowed in psychological studies. And I forget the actual name of the study. It's a very famous study, and it'll probably come to me on the ride home because it's world famous. Where they basically took really young children, and a group of them, all they did was praise them. You are a genius. You're the smartest kid I've ever seen. You're the most talented. I mean, just lied out the wazoo to these kids. And another group of kids got negative feedback, like, well, you could have done better. You should have done better. You're not as good as the other kids. You know, you're probably never going to get into Harvard. And in the end, the kids that were fed the positive lived up to what their potential was. They by and large lived up to that, and likewise. Now, ethically, that's a horrible study, right? Because you just kind of like, can we borrow your kid and see if we ruin their life by not giving them positive reinforcement? I mean, who's going to volunteering your kid for that, right, is kind of creating something not good. Sure, we won't give our kid positive reinforcement for 3 years, and we'll see how that goes. Self-fulfilling prophecy. There's truth in that. And that's what's being described of the high priest here in Leviticus 21, verse 8. That's the technology that's being described in that verse. Even the smallest of actions can have the greatest of consequences. In fact, the whole reason you may be in this world is to come and to perform one and only one single, small, tiny action. And that's it. But it might have the greatest consequence of all. That's the technology of the high priest here. But that's the technology we can tap into. All right, we will close there for this evening. I believe we will meet next week. I'm like 80% sure, so stay tuned to your email. If you're not on the email list, give me your email. Plan on it. If you don't hear any differently, plan on it. But our home in Kentucky is selling or closing next week. Yes, so. And Wednesday is when the movers show up to get the stuff. I don't anticipate having to be there on that day, but I don't know. So that's why I say I'm in the 80-90% range. I shouldn't have to go to Kentucky until Thursday evening or Friday before sun kicks in, sunsets. So hang in there for that. And then coming up, even if we meet next week, there'll probably be a couple of Wednesdays we won't meet because we're having a conference here at St. Peter's that's is on a Wednesday, and some other things that are coming up on the church calendar that would preclude us from meeting, but I will keep you abreast on that. But do plan for next week unless you hear otherwise. Unless you hear otherwise, same time, same place. All right, let's close with the blessing. Baruch atah Adonai noten hadabar. Blessed are you, Lord God, who has given to us your word. Amen.